I am so honored to get to be a part of a church that really does life together well. And I think about our communities, I think about our campuses, and I think about South Creek specifically. And one of the things I love is that we are all engaged in life together. We're all doing things together, we're growing together. So if you're on the fence about one of those retreats and you're not sure, or if you're nervous or scared, just encourage you to push through that little bit, find somebody to connect with, and I promise you it will be totally worth your time and your energy. I want to talk today about something that can take you from zero to 100 in a split second. It has divided families and friendships. No matter who you are or what age you are, you've been affected by it to the heart of who we are. And so with closing this polarized series today, it's with great gravity and care that I want to talk about attitude. And maybe as we think about that, I mentioned that to Danielle earlier that I was going to talk about attitude this week, and she said, yeah, the great eye roll, right? I said, yeah, maybe, possibly. Parents in the room, we know this, grandparents and parents, even on a friendship level, there are those moments where the simplest expression can affect you in a way that you didn't expect, can catch you off guard. And there's more in communication than just the words that are coming out of our mouths, right? Sometimes the biggest apologies I've made to my kids have been in moments where I responded to the attitude that I was getting from them with the same attitude back. There's something funny about attitudes, though. We seem to know on an instinctive level that there is more to communicating with the people around us than just our words. Why is it that somebody in your friendship group or your family can tell you that they're fine? And we understand in that moment that they're anything but fine. I had a friend who had to have 6 bypasses on their heart and didn't know it, went to the hospital, wasn't feeling good, had 6 bypasses. And I talked to his wife the Sunday after that surgery. And I'm like, hey, how are you holding up? And she goes, I'm good. I said, Karen, you're not good. It's okay. You can let people know how you really are. And she goes, I know. Why do we do that, right? And wouldn't you know, the very next person that walked up, like 3 seconds later, Karen, how are you holding up? I'm good. It's built into who we are as a culture that we try and read around each other's expressions and the communication that's happening. But I think so often what is really most true about us is what we all can see. The thing that is most true about us is what we're feeling in any given moment. And the funny thing about attitudes is that they are postures we take. Attitudes are postures we take. In fact, the word attitude was originally coined, the term was made up to describe how painters would position the person that they were painting to express the emotion that they wanted to convey to their audience. So if they wanted to convey that somebody was feeling sad or lonely, they might position them a certain way. If they wanted to convey that they were happy, they might position them a certain way. Right? If you scroll through your phone for just a couple minutes and you look at pictures of your kids, you don't have to look hard to remember what happened in that moment, right? There's these freeze frames of, oh man, that was a really fun day, or hey, remember that day? We have this picture. I wish I would have put it up because I just thought of it now and it's perfect. But it's a picture of Marigold getting stuck in her shirt. She was putting on her sweater one morning and it got halfway over her face and she got stuck. And as she was looking up at me, she went, so being the wonderful dad that I am, I took out my phone and took a picture. And Danielle later posted on social media, Daddy made the right call. So see, I knew it was right. We had to capture that cute moment. But like that ever popular picture of the husband saying he's listening with his mouth, but not with his eyes fixed on his bride, something is being communicated. Or the child that says, I didn't mean to punch my brother, when there's a very particular grin on their face with how much pain they inflicted and how much justice they distributed. If you've ever had a moment where you've been looking at a friend who is saying sorry and realizing that they're saying it in the least convincing tone in the world, you've experienced this. I think that what this reveals is that attitudes are outward expressions of what we believe in our hearts. Attitudes are outward expressions of what we really believe. If you think someone is silly or ridiculous or maybe even stupid, in our family we say we don't say stupid, so Danielle said you can't say that. I said it, sorry. You're going to have a really hard time not expressing that to them, right? The word choice, the body language that you're expressing to them is going to, that's going to come across how we really feel about them in that moment. There's a good possibility that the moments that you've stuck your foot in your mouth most are not a problem because you didn't mean to say what you said. It's most likely more awkward because on some level you really did. Trevor just raised his hand. I love you, Trevor. That's our pastor right there. At the heart of everything we have talked about over the past month is this idea. Attitude is the issue. And the attitude that we are called to model, the number one attitude we are called to model is Christ's. Christ's attitude, especially when it comes to reconciliation. And the question we have to ask is, what attitude keeps us from doing the work of reconciliation? What attitude is it that keeps us from doing the work of reconciliation? I think the first thing that keeps us from doing the work of reconciliation, the actual work of stepping out, of meeting somebody where they're at, being a peacemaker like we've talked about over these past couple weeks, is that we forget where we started in our faith. Forget where we started. As I look around the room, I'm seeing faces and I'm seeing testimonies that I know of people in the room, and there's many of you that I haven't gotten to meet yet, and many of your testimonies that I haven't heard. But for all of us who would claim to follow Christ, there was a moment when we decided, hey, I want to do something different. And in that moment, we took a step towards Christ. And in that moment, we changed something about the way we used to think and the way we used to believe. And if I'm honest, there's so many times when I'm trying to counsel with somebody or I'm trying to talk to somebody that my first reaction is like, man, why don't they get it? Like, this is so obvious. Especially with our social media feeds, right? You can scroll through and you'll get information that reinforces your ideas really quickly. And as you're scrolling through, you're like, yeah, duh. Why don't people get this, right? And the thing that the Lord always whispers in my ear in that moment is, hey, Sean, how long did it take you to get it? And in that moment, I'm like, I hate that question. Because if I'm honest, it took a while. It took a lot of counseling from friends and family. It took a lot of hard conversations with God when I was like, I don't really know if I can trust you. I don't really want to know if I want to give all of myself to you. But at the end of all that was that moment when I was like, God, you're the only thing that makes sense. And I think the problem for some of us is that we forget that that's where we started. The longer we're in our faith, the longer that we're surrounded with people who believe like we believe and love like we love, we can forget what it was like at the start, how hard that choice was. So Philippians 2, where we're going to dig in today, we're just going to kind of walk through this a little bit verse by verse and just kind of talk it out for a minute. But I think the place that he starts is this. In Philippians 2, verse 1, he says, is there any encouragement from belonging to Christ? Any comfort from his love? Any fellowship together in the Spirit? Are your hearts tender and compassionate? I think this is really what he's getting at. Do you remember the start? Or all of those things that God did at first, did you kind of forget those and get into the ritual of faith? Or is it still about compassion? Is it still about comforting those around us? Is it still about the love of being together? I think he's saying to the people here, remember what the Lord brought you out of. Remember what he brought you out of. And that's honestly, a lot of the songs that we choose to sing in service, that's what these songs are meant to do. They're meant to remind our hearts of who God is first and foremost, but also what he brought us out of. Also, the way that we can connect with our testimony. There was this moment in a service once when a band was singing Amazing Grace, How Sweet the Sound, and it was a pretty traditional version, right? A version that us younger folk, if I can say that, maybe would not gravitate towards naturally. But I watched as my father lifted his hands in worship, and he was holding Riley right here at that moment. And I watched Riley look at Papa and then go, phew. I watched the two of them connect with their testimony. And that's why we choose the songs that we do and what we're hoping to happen in this service as we continue to worship the Lord in all of these different forms is that we are reminded of who God is and what he brought us out of. and that that would humble us in a way that we can comfort each other. We can do life together. He goes on from there and says, then make me truly happy by agreeing wholeheartedly with each other, loving one another, working together with one mind and purpose. That's the unity that we talked about last week in service. I was over at McKinley, but I know Trevor did an amazing job, because he always does, communicating that here too, that unity is what we are called to. And there's this really cool kind of interchange in our faith where God, by his grace, somehow allows us to be unified and still have our individuality. We can still have all the gifts and the beauty of the individual ways that he made us. I'm never trying to be Trevor. Trevor's never trying to be me. But we can be unified in what we believe and how we practice our faith and still be ourselves. And I think that's one of the most beautiful things about our faith, is that God allows that. He goes on and says, don't be selfish and do not try to impress others. Be humble, thinking of others as better than yourself. Don't look out only for your own interest, but take the interests of others too. I hope that as members of Revive and people who attend here on a regular basis, that we are known as being the examples of this, that we are known for seeking to understand others' point of views before just expressing our own. That we are known by letting others speak first and offering suggestions and helpful thoughts and insights. That we are known for giving others the benefit of the doubt. That's an easy one, right? Giving each other the benefit of the doubt. And this is hard work, and it takes sacrifice. I said that last week when we were at McKinley, that the funny thing about unity is that it means that we all move to the middle, right? I used to do the college ministry for years in another church, and I would love when the older generation and the younger generation would be like, let's be unified. Like, awesome. Who's going first? And there was always a standoff of like, well, you come our way. No, you come our way, right? But unity requires sacrifice. We have to be willing to sacrifice for each other. But all of this is more than a task. It's meant to reveal and change our hearts at the same time. In verse 5, he says, you must have the same attitude that Jesus had. And this brings us to that reality that attitudes are postures, and postures communicate something. Because the truth is, we do the hard work of reconciliation because Jesus did it for us. We do the hard work of reconciliation. That's a hard word to say. Because Jesus did it first. We do it because he did it first. And this could be a guilt-ridden statement, right? I don't know if you guys have ever been in services where who's ever preaching is like, just go do better. You're like, okay, sorry. And that's not what I want today to be about. This is not supposed to be a guilt-ridden, just do better moment. It's not just do the work because Jesus did it. But it's remembering that he's walking us through a process. And the process always starts with what we want. And the first thing, if you think about your own testimony, you think about what Christ has done for you, the first thing he did, I'm sure, is change what you want. Long before he changed your actions. Long before he made you do different stuff, right? I think sometimes we get this mixed up in faith because we're like, we almost feel like we're taking medicine and we're like, well, I guess I'll just act different now because that's what Christianity is, right? But long before he does that, he changes the very thing that we want. And out of that desire, all of a sudden our actions start to change. If you're like me and you like ice cream way too much, at some point, there was some moments there. I was watching people like, yeah, I know. The moments are like when you realize, hey, I actually want what's better for me. I don't just want another bowl of ice cream, even though it's really good. I want a salad. Trevor and I have this conversation a lot. This goes on in verse 6-8 and says, though he was God, he did not think of equality with God as something to cling to. Sounds super straightforward, right? Super easy statement. I was writing it out and was thinking about it this week, and I'm like, what does that mean? I mean, there's times in church, right, where you hit these verses and you're like, yeah, sure. And everyone just kind of nods. You look around the circle and everyone's like, yeah, I get that. And then somebody, at some point, somebody says, like, I have no idea what that means. And we're all like, oh, good. Thanks. I have no idea what that means. That's a hard thing to wrap your head around. Jesus is God, but does not consider equality with God something to be grasped when he was human, but also God. Super straightforward. But Paul goes on here to explain how this actually plays out. And I love that. He kind of drops this statement and then says, all right, let me explain. He says, instead, he gave up his divine privilege. He took the humble position of a slave and was born as a human being. We talked about the attitudes being postures and postures communicating something, right? And the reality here is that the attitude that he's displaying here is in this first statement. He gave up his divine privilege. That's an attitude, right? That he was willing to take what was his and give it up. Lift it up to his Father. And he took a humble position, the position of a slave. That's a posture, right? That he was willing to kneel down and say, you know what, I'm not going to take this position and this posture that I need to be in control, that I need to be in charge. I'm going to take the position and the attitude of humility. And what does that communicate to us? I think the simplest way to say it is that this attitude shows us that the posture of humility is dependence. Dependence. Humility is all about dependence. And I think that's why sometimes we struggle with it. Because the American dream is to be as independent as possible, right? I have all my stuff. I can talk to my neighbor, but I would rather that my neighbor needs something from me than I need something from my neighbor, right? I had a friend once who said, like, if we think about it, one neighborhood should own a mower. I was like, that's a good argument. I have a hard time really saying why we all need to own mowers, right? Like, if we were doing this perfectly, I'm not saying, like, give up your mower. Just hear me clearly. But in reality, if we were all just sharing, it wouldn't be an issue. If we were all living this Christian ethic perfectly, it wouldn't be an issue. And I think that's what humility and that dependence looks like, is that God has called us to step out of the place where we are so independent that we don't need anyone, especially him, and step into a place where we are in full dependence of him. Some of the best times in my life, some of the best times in my walk with him were moments where I'm like, I have no idea how this is going to work out. It makes zero sense on paper. But every time I've been in one of those places, the Lord provides, and I'm like, I'm so glad that that was the case. Because I got to see you at work. I got to see you do something that I wouldn't have gotten to see you do if I was independent. He goes on and says, when he appeared in human form, he humbled himself in obedience to God and died a criminal's death on the cross. We see the same pattern here. Obedience to God is an attitude. It's an attitude. And the death on the cross is the posture. That's the posture that he chose to take. And there's a lot of things that communicates and a lot of things that we talk about in church about the gospel and the grace and the mercy that communicates, but that also communicates something else. And I think what it communicates to me is determination. That he was determined to be obedient to God. It was decided ahead of time. He was determined that obedience to God is worth dying for. You can be determined to do a lot of things for a lot of different reasons, but are we determined to obey Christ even if it ends up costing us our life for that obedience? And for most of us, it's very unlikely that it will ever come down to that. But at the heart of this issue is the importance of obedience in our lives. How important is it that we are obedient to God? This is not, again, a just do it moment where we're like, just go be obedient to God, do better. This is a question of what you really want. Do you want what God's will is for your life? If so, obedience is not necessarily easy. But I think if we let him change our desire, it becomes the most natural thing for us. Yeah, of course I'll obey you. Why wouldn't I? That becomes our first response. And there's a lot of different ways this plays out at work, at home, in school. But I just wanted to talk about this one for a minute. At work, are we going to remain in the place of dependence of God? Or are we going to do everything we can do to get noticed? There was a while in my life where I thought if I just did good enough job as a pastor, if I just spoke good enough, if I just sang the song good enough, if I promoted a service good enough, if enough people showed up, that God would be impressed and that he would bless what we were doing. And the older I get and the longer that I'm in faith, the more I realize that it's only a gift that I'm even part of the equation. And that all of the pressure is not on me for God to do anything in any one of these services or in any aspect of your life. We talk a lot at Revive about ministering and discipling and reaching out to the people around you in your workspaces, at home, at school. And what I don't want us to hear, I think, as Revive, we don't want you to hear at any given point, is that you just need to suck it up and try harder to tell people about Jesus. The reality is that, man, if we're living with this kind of dependence, with this kind of determination to be obedient to God, that so often he does the work ahead of time and just invites us in to put a nice little bow on the conversation. We were praying for our sister-in-law at one point, and she doesn't know the Lord yet, but we continue to pray for her. And the one day, she just walked up to us and said, "You know, we're waiting for you to have conversations with us about Jesus." I was like, "What?" I was not ready for that, right? But if I think about my testimony and the things that the Lord has walked us through, that has more often been the case than times where I was like all up in somebody's face being like, "Hey, do you see this? Do you see what this verse says about your lifestyle? Do you see why this is right and you're wrong?" Not that any of us do that purely, right? I'm not saying that that's all of us or any of us really. But the reality is that I think so often God is inviting us to take a step back from being in the driver's seat, from being in control, and in humility say, "You are the God who's going to change this person. You are the God who's going to transform this person. And maybe the best thing that I can do is get out of your way." Because more than anything else, I think the truth is that we need to let people hear the name Jesus before they hear your name. And that's what it ultimately comes down to for me. That's what that humility looks like for me. Are people saying, "Man, I'm really glad Sean is in my life because he's such a great guy and he's always there for me"? Or are they saying like, "Oh, I'm so glad I have Jesus"? Are we creating churches and relationships where people are dependent on us? Are we creating churches and relationships where people are dependent on Jesus? And in those moments, we get to just walk alongside of them. And the beauty is, for us as a church, it just takes all of the pressure off to make something happen. We just get to lean in and watch him work. Jumping ahead here to verses 9, it says, "Therefore God elevated him to a place of highest honor and gave him the name above all names, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and in earth and under the earth, and every tongue declare that Jesus is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." I think this so beautifully reveals God's heart for us. The goal of all this is for Jesus to be glorified, for Jesus to be lifted high. I think sometimes as Christians, the difficult part in this, and just practically want to run through this super fast, we expect people to become like us first. We expect that the first thing they're going to do is become like us. And after they become like us for a little bit, that they'll start to feel a sense of belonging. And then after belonging with us for a little bit, they will eventually come to believe. And that can happen. It does happen sometimes. But I found more often for people that the first thing that happens is that they need to feel like they belong with us. I was thinking about this in the context of like a job. You get hired, and on day one, you belong, whether you like it or not, right? Like, you're one of us now. Hooray, get to work. And I think there's something to that reality, that when you're in a space that's safe enough to belong first, where you can say, I don't really totally agree with these people, but they're my people, that opens the door to let God work, doesn't it? That opens the door for God to start to move that person in a direction to where they go from belonging to believing. They start to believe because they can actually tangibly see it play out then, right? That's where this dependence is so powerful, because they come alongside of you, they realize these are my people, and they start to realize, hey, like, you actually love Jesus. And when hard things come up in your life, you're not freaking out. What's wrong with you? And as that happens, they start to go from a place of believing to becoming. They become like us, to the place where they say, you know what? I don't want Jesus to just be a nice idea for me. I want him to be my Lord too. I want him to be my Savior too. I want to have the peace that you have in your life. It's easy to stand with our arms crossed, rolling our eyes at people who don't think like we do, who don't act like we do. But I think the reality, if we think about that again, reality that attitudes are postures, and postures communicate something, all flows up from the heart, right? And if we go back to that initial picture of God giving up his godhood, taking the position of humility, instead of at the end of that, him pulling everything back and being like, it's mine. What is the next thing, the next posture that he said to take? He spread his arms wide in sacrifice and welcome to say, this is what love and humility looks like. So we're going to sing this song in a second that says that Jesus is the Son of Suffering. And that's really what we're talking about. The humility of a God who would come and suffer on your behalf so that you could know him, but also model our lives after him. That we could have the same attitude, that all of these gifts that he's put in us, all of these gifts that he's provided for us, aren't something to cling to. But the only thing that we have to do is to open our arms and our hearts and say, God, you use them, you work, you change, you transform. I just want to lead us in this prayer, and then we'll sing. Father, show us where we have been viewing others from a worldly perspective, and help us to view them as you do. Jesus, forgive us for when we do not have the attitude of humility. We repent from pride and making quick judgments. Make us more like you. Spirit, draw those who do not yet believe and want to be reconciled to Jesus, and continue your holy work in my life so that I can grow in holiness and become more like Jesus Christ. Amen. Would you stand and sing?